This is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. He's not defending the man, he's defending his constitutional due process rights, says Senator Chris Van Hollen, Maryland Democrat, about his trip to El Salvador, where a man from Maryland was wrongly taken to a notorious prison, say U.S. courts.
My mission and my purpose is to make sure that we uphold the rule of law, because if we take it away from him, we do jeopardize it for everybody else.
Kilmar Abrego Garcia denies being a criminal gang member, as the Trump administration claims. Senator demands evidence be presented in court. Two people, including a child, have died in Oklahoma flooding. Forecasters warn more flooding. Thunderstorms, tornadoes are expected from the Midwest to the South. Visitors to the Vatican on Easter Sunday got a treat, a surprise, at St. Peter's Basilica. At the end of the Easter service, Pope Francis showed up to bless the crowd.
Cari fratelli e sorelle.
And the Pope treated people in St. Peter's Square to a surprise Popemobile tour. This is ABC News. Closing arguments expected over a woman convicted of murder, Lori Daybell, acting as her own attorney, says ABC's Zorin Shah.
Lori has maintained she is not guilty, instead claiming her brother Alex killed Charles Vallow in self-defense. Alex, not around to tell his version of the story because he passed away shortly after from natural causes. Lori is currently serving a life sentence in Idaho for the murders of the children and conspiracy to murder Chad's wife.
While the nearly 14-year Syrian civil war came to an end with the fall of Bashar Assad last December, war remnants continue to kill and maim. Contamination from landmines and explosive remnants has killed at least 249 people, including 60 children, and injured another 379 since December, according to INSO, an international organization which coordinates safety for aid workers. Police investigating an overnight shooting at Norfolk State University. Chuck Sievertson, ABC News.
This is a story of the one. As a maintenance specialist for university housing, he knows college students can major in wear and tear. Plus, housing so many students doesn't leave a lot of room to house all the supplies he needs. That's where Grainger comes in. With over a million industrial-grade products and fast, dependable delivery, Grainger carries the quality products he needs so he doesn't have to. From a new door hinge to a whole new faucet. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
April is Global Volunteer Month. Find the perfect volunteer opportunities for you at volunteerwisconsin.org or contact your local United Way or Volunteer Center today. Volunteerwisconsin.org is hosted by United Way of Wisconsin and Serve Wisconsin. Paid for by United Way of Wisconsin.
That first time seeing my son, I feel like my life did a 180. He really a definition of like why he loves somebody.
Through all of fatherhood's firsts, never stop being a dad. Visit fatherhood.gov to hear more. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. A nonprofit is working to help the farmers who lost federal grant money. Judith Ruiz Branch reports.
The Honor Farmer Contracts Act would order the United States Department of Agriculture to resume paying farmers from previously signed agreements. The Michael Fields Agriculture Institute is one of more than 350 organizations that have signed on to a letter of support to Congress. Ryan Martin, the executive director, says federal cuts have impacted both their network and their organization.
There's also a lot of legal and operational chaos. So we're sort of stuck navigating these legal gray zones around signed contracts. My part-time job right now, unfortunately, has been canceling contracts and laying off contractors, and we've had to lay off several staff.
The act would require the USDA to unfreeze all signed agreements and contracts, make past due payments quickly, and prohibit the agency from canceling contracts unless there is a breach of contract. The sudden cuts blindsided farmers across the country. Hundreds of farmers in the upper Midwest region participate in USDA-funded programs that pay farmers for serving their communities. Clint Bland, owner of Bland Family Farm and Farms of Illinois.
This funding has far more impacts than just paying one farmer. All this food was going out throughout the communities that we were serving to disadvantaged folks who needs food. And then it was also helping the business, and everything was just kind of flowing around. It kept the money right here and helped out the community.
Bland says the uncertainty has forced him to make operational changes, such as staff cuts and modifications to planting strategies to mitigate potential losses. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. On our Easter Sunday, look for some showers in the afternoon with highs reaching the upper 50s. Gusty east winds will develop. For tonight, rain, even some thunderstorms around, and some of that rain will be locally heavy. Breezy as lows drop to the lower 40s. Currently 49 degrees.
Earl Ingram.
It's Motown Monday on the Earl Ingram Show, and I'm dedicating this episode to you, the listeners. Your voices matter, and I want to hear how significantly we influence your lives.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings at 9.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, LaCrosse's home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. As always, I am both honored and delighted that you have chosen to spend some portion of this weekend in conversation, in discussion, in consumption of the latest news in our nation and across the planet when it comes to issues related to the rule of law, the delivery of justice, and government in general. This weekend, a special edition. A very special edition of Amicus, a law review, doing some things in this broadcast that we have not previously done in the several years that we've been on the air. And that includes, at the center of our broadcast this weekend, my recitation to you on one of the most significant statements of civic responsibility, of what government does, of what we should expect from our government, of due process and of the fundamental rights under our Constitution that has been written about in years. And it comes from an appeals court called the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about this major commission issued by three federal judges on Thursday of this past week that should give us hope for the future, that should give us a commission about what should happen next, and that also should tell our government what the expectations that we all have for its conduct and its behavior. That's going to be the centerpiece of our broadcast this weekend. As always, however, we invite your communications, your questions, your inquiries about that and other matters, which I will identify in our syllabus, as we always do, by calling in at 855-752-4842. My terrific producer, Max, always reminds me as well that you can also be a part of our conversation by dropping a question or an inquiry into our chat box. But be a part of our discussion because of the special nature of this particular broadcast this weekend. This weekend, I'm going to hold off on calls until the second hour, but going to be encouraging those with great enthusiasm, as always, inviting you to be a part of this all-important discussion. That number, once again, 855-752-4842. Write down your questions. Write down your inquiries, because, as always, it is a lot. It is a lot to consume. And, indeed, much of what we have to consume is a part of our syllabus this weekend. We're going to begin by talking about some very late-breaking news coming across the headlines just in the past several hours, coming out of our United States Supreme Court that issued a major ruling very early this Saturday morning that affects due process in America, that affects the courts in America, affects our understanding of what our government can and should do to provide service and support, safety and understanding for all of us in our nation. That's at the top of our hour. We're then going to go back a couple of days, mixing up the chronology a bit. We're going to go back to Wednesday and talk about something that James Boasberg did. You recall well, he is this federal district court judge in the District of Columbia who has been presiding for well over a month now over one of the major cases involving Venezuelan migrants. And yes, indeed, their extrajudicial shipment, deportation to that high security, brutal prison in El Salvador, where approximately 238 of them are still incarcerated to this day. We're going to talk about what James Boasberg said this past week that changes the calculus of all of this. Finding that there is reasonable cause to believe that your government, your U.S. Department of Justice, your president is in contempt of the orders of a federal court. We'll talk about what he said. We'll talk about the process, the due process that he is going to be giving to your government and the representatives of it in a way that they themselves did not afford to those deportees now in El Salvador. James Boasberg looming large in these stories, the reports about the rule of law this past week. Then we're going to go back one day and talk about another judge who's been much in our focus. Her name is Paula Zinnes, and she has also been presiding over one of these very notorious cases, no less significant than the other, and that is that Maryland man. Improperly, by the government's own admission, through fault, through administrative error is what they called it, packaged up, deported to El Salvador, visited just recently by a United States senator. And so we know that he is still alive. We know that he is still there, but we don't know anything else about what's going on with him. And we don't know the questions that both Judge Zinnes and Judge Boasberg have asked. We don't know the answers to those questions because the government, your government, has not provided them. And we'll talk as well about what Judge Zinnes has done, much in line with what Judge Boasberg has done, approaching that time of contempt by your government in a federal district court. Judge Zinnes saying, I'm going to get to the bottom of this once again, as she did on Tuesday, admonishing the representatives, your lawyers, standing in front of her and telling them that she is going to permit the plaintiffs, the petitioners, the people, again, in particular, who are advocating on behalf of that Maryland man, she is going to permit them to pursue what's called discovery, depositions. She is talking about oral testimony in her courtroom to get to the bottom of this. Why, once again? Because your government, your U.S. Department of Justice, under this president and under this attorney general, her name is Pamela Bondi, as you know, have refused repeatedly to provide the basic answers to the questions that Judge Boasberg has been asking, that Judge Zinnes has been asking, and in that context, moving toward formal findings of contempt. We're going to talk a little bit more about the predicates for that under something called 18 U.S.C. Section 401 and 402, the federal statutes that do indeed give judges the capacity, the authority to find entities. Almost never the government itself, but here the government itself in contempt of court. And then necessarily we're going to be asking what that means. We'll be asking the question and providing you, yes, indeed, with an answer in this broadcast about whether or not we are in a constitutional crisis. And I will tell you in anticipation of that discussion that that answer has long been given. And that the question we should now be asking is, what are we prepared to do to preserve our republic? The question that Benjamin Franklin asked of all of us over these many years, the question of whether we are prepared to protect it. That's the question that we are now asking as we continue to examine the rule of law issues, the justice issues, the government issues that have animated just the past several days. And yes, indeed, we're going to spend a lot of time. You're going to hear what the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals has said to us, to the government, to Donald Trump, to Pam Bondi, to all the representatives who appear in court across this nation on behalf of you and behalf of our government. We're going to hear the stellar, the transcendent words that we have not heard in many, many years from an appeals court judge. They're the kinds of words, kinds of language that we have previously heard from a Supreme Court talking with us in lofty, important ways about the arc of justice and about what we should expect in our nation. the kinds of things that previous justices of the Supreme Court rallied when it came to understanding changes in the law, movements toward greater civil rights. Once again, the Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. You may be wondering already, where is the Fourth Circuit? It's basically the Mid-Atlantic states. It's the district courts in West Virginia and Virginia and North Carolina and South Carolina. The Court of Appeals meets in Richmond this past week. A major statement that takes its place among the major, major articulations of the rule of law in our American history in 238 years. It is necessary that we all hear that this weekend and in the days and weeks and months and years ahead to understand what our nation is all about and what is at stake right now when it comes not only to representations made in front of Judge Boasberg and Judge Zinnes, but also to the United States Supreme Court, which is where we'll begin in just a moment. We are necessarily, however, going to be recognizing, as we sometimes do here on Amicus Law Review, a major event, a commemoration of a major event in United States American history. Not yet the United States at the time that this happened, 250 years ago this weekend. 250 years ago on April 19th of 1775. A major series of events necessarily understood by all of us today. Yes, indeed, Lexington and Concord, those shots, the shot, other shots heard round the world as historians have since codified it. I'm going to spend some time beginning now recalling what happened in that mid-April days of April of 1775. Why? Because we understand the contemporary events of our days, of the past several days, not as the physical shots that began our own Revolutionary War 250 years ago, but nonetheless the shots being taken right now to our republic, to our Constitution. The shots are also heard not just here in Wisconsin, not just here in the United States, in those courtrooms in Richmond and in the District of Columbia, and also obviously in Maryland as well, but in courtrooms around our nation, in rule of law institutions, our law enforcement services, shots being taken again, not physically, not violent shots in the physical violence sense, but shots about who we are as Americans. And necessarily we're going to begin in our broadcast today by talking about what happened in mid-April of 1775, a British general named Thomas Gage, that was his name, he decided to set all of this off. He couldn't possibly have anticipated what he was doing, but he decided to seize some weapons and some gunpowder that were being stored, yes, indeed, at that place called Concord, Massachusetts, a word, a place in our nation's history that still rings large. About 20 miles northwest of Boston, he was facing what everybody thought was an impending rebellion. And to prevent violence, he decided that he was going to seize those weapons and the gunpowder. The Patriot spies already at work in that time got wind of Thomas Gage's plan at the time. A fellow named Paul Revere, you know him well from your history books. We think about the poetry that also animates our recollection of our history lessons. Paul Revere, other writers, spread the word of about 800 British soldiers who were dispatched to Concord. Departing late in the evening of April 18th from Boston, the King's troops marched into the small town of Lexington around 5 a.m., and there they found facing them a militia of patriots, about 70 men, and they were led by a captain named John Parker. As Amicus Law Review continues, I'm going to tell you more about the shots heard around the world 250 years ago today as a predicate to our further discussion in this broadcast about the shots in America having to do with the rule of law and justice. Stay with us for all of that.
You're listening to the Talk of La Crosse, Eagle 1490 AM.
It's the Eco Minute, powered by Clean Wisconsin, your environmental voice since 1970. I'm Amy Berrio. Could coal make a comeback in Wisconsin? Pollution and high costs have pushed utilities to start shutting down coal plants across the state. But the Trump administration has announced emergency orders to boost coal, including offering power plants a two-year exemption from requirements to reduce emissions of toxic chemicals like mercury, arsenic, and benzene. April 22nd marks the 55th anniversary of Earth Day. Back in 1970, Wisconsin Senator Gaylord Nelson called for an environmental day of action that inspired 20 million Americans to take to the streets and demand protections from environmental contamination. Less than 8 months later, Congress created the EPA. Knowledge is power. For a deep dive into environmental issues in Wisconsin, check out my Defender podcast at cleanwisconsin.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, Lacrosse's home for the Todd Allball Show.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Solar Review, a special edition of our broadcast this weekend, beginning with a commemoration of this major event in American history 250 years ago, this Saturday, this weekend, April 19th, 1775, as the forces of British General Thomas Gage convene on the town of Lexington, confronting this militia of about 70 men, some patriots. They're led by Captain John Parker. And when that vanguard of British forces rushed upon the town green there in Lexington, Captain Parker, Captain John Parker, realizing that he is probably outgunned, outmanned, orders his troops to disperse. And at some point, historians are unclear about exactly when, where, how, who did this. A shot rings out. Historians still debating exactly who fired that first shot, but the nervous British soldiers fired a volley in response to how that first shot is received. They killed seven and they mortally wounded one of the retreating militiamen, the patriots at that day. The British column then moved on toward Concord from Lexington, leaving the dead, the wounded, and the dying in their wake, a part of our American history. People dying 250 years ago today to begin to establish what would become the United States of America. Parker and his men would have revenge, however, later on that very afternoon. Arriving in Concord about 8 a.m., the British commanders, their name were Francis Smith and John Pitcairn, ordered several of their companies at that time, about 220 troops in all, to ensure the security of the North Bridge across the Concord River, and then continue another mile on to a place called Barrett Farm. You may recall much of this from your history books and your history lessons of the times that you're in school. And it was there at Barrett Farm that a suspected cache of arms and powder was presumably, again, historians somewhat unclear on this, located. By the time the British arrived at the North Bridge, a growing assembly of close to 400 militia from Concord and the surrounding towns had gathered on the high ground overlooking that bridge. News of all of this, what was happening in Lexington, now in Concord, passing through the public, the community of that time. From their vantage point on the hill, they could see some smoke, some very interesting smoke rising from Concord, the result of British burning some supplies that they had uncovered. But thinking, however, at the time, that the town itself, their own town, was being put to fire, being torched at the time, Lieutenant Joseph Hosmer of Concord shouted to his fellow officers, again, the history of 250 years ago today. He said, "Will you let them burn the town down? Will you let them burn their town down?" Words that should be important to us today when we think about what we are prepared to do to preserve our own republic 250 years later. He said, "Will you let them burn the town down?" The decision was then made to take action. Colonel James Barrett ordered his companies to march upon the bridge, but not to fire. "Do not fire," he said, "on the British soldiers unless first fired upon." And a thing called the Acton Company, these are the Minutemen, commanded by a 30-year-old captain, 30 years old. His name is Isaac Davis at that time, and he was placed at the head of the column and was asked, when asked if they were prepared to confront the British troops, Davis said this. He said, "I haven't a man afraid to go." No one among my troops, he said, is afraid to defend our belief in fundamental notions of decency and rightness. And yes, indeed, although they did not talk about it at that time as due process and equal protection and the kinds of things that we will spend most of our broadcast talking about today, he said, I haven't a man afraid to go, raising again the question for us now. Are we afraid to go forward to protect our republic? The Minutemen formed up and they marched down the hill, according to historians. And as they did that, the British soldiers, intimidated now by the colonial numbers, far exceeding what they saw early in the day, orderly advance, they retreated to the opposite shore and prepared to defend themselves. And when Davis's company, again, according to all of the reliable accounts, came within range, British soldiers opened fire. They killed Isaac Davis and also Abner Hosmer and another Acton Minuteman. Major Buttrick of Concord shouted, "For God's sake, fire." For God's sake, fire. That happened 250 years ago today, Concord and Lexington. And the Minutemen replied with their own volley, killing three British soldiers, wounding nine other Brits. This volley right then, right there, following the first shots, this volley is considered the shots heard around the world, and the rest of the British troops retreated back into town. Smith and Pitcairn ordered a return to Boston, which devolved into a rout as thousands of Minutemen patriots descended on the area after what had happened in Lexington and Concord. The British were attacked from all sides by this what can only be described as a swarm, huge numbers of angry Minutemen, along what is now known, you may recall this as well, as Battle Road. And when they reached Lexington, John Parker and his men had their revenge. They fired on the British regulars from behind cover, and for the next 12 miles, the British were continually ambushed by the Minutemen who were there. They were shooting from trees and rock walls and buildings and other edifices. The emotions of the fight carried well beyond April 19th, inspiring American warriors on that day and others to rise up and fight again, even in the face of staggering odds against them. That's what happened. That's what happened 250 years ago today. You recall as well from your literature classes, maybe your history classes as well, Ralph Waldo Emerson, who was a Concord poet. He dubbed these people the embattled farmers. They were not American citizens yet. They did not know what had started on that day. They could not possibly have seen what would happen 250 years later. They would have to wait until 1776 and the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution that followed years after that. But on April 19, 1775, they were loyal British subjects of the British government who believed that they were standing up to defend and fight for their rights. That's what they were fighting for 250 years ago today. In doing so, they changed the world forever. And that is the question that we ask today, as we have asked in recent weeks and will continue to ask on the broadcast stations here of Civic Media. What are we prepared to do now to defend our republic, to follow up on that battle cry, if you will, not to violence, not to that kind of deathly, fatal aggression, but to preserve what Ben Franklin talked about, preserving the republic, if indeed you can preserve it. They changed the world forever. Are we prepared to change it today to ensure that the history of the past 90 days, the past 3 months or so, is not the history that continues beyond? Because we do undeniably today, in weeks past, in days past, and continuing to this day, have undeniably not just a constitutional crisis, but we've got a challenge to the very fabric of our nation. That is the principal thesis, the premise of my argument to you today, based upon the things that we are now going to talk about. And that includes indeed what the United States Supreme Court, weighing into this very issue, has done just in the early morning hours of this Saturday. This live broadcast, if you're listening again tomorrow afternoon or on a podcast, it happened in the very early morning hours of April 19th, 2025. The United States Supreme Court, early in the morning, blocking the Trump administration early Saturday from deporting another group of Venezuelan immigrants accused of being gang members under the so-called expansive powers of this rarely invoked law. that the administration is attempting to use to accomplish something illegal. When we come back, I'll tell you more about what the Supreme Court did, about what the courts of appeals are doing, what district courts are doing here on Amicus, a law review.
Eagle 1490 AM.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. He's not defending the man, he's defending his constitutional due process rights, says Senator Chris Van Hollen, Maryland Democrat, about his trip to El Salvador, where a man from Maryland was wrongly taken to a notorious prison, say U.S. courts.
My mission and my purpose is to make sure that we uphold the rule of law, because if we take it away from him, we do jeopardize it for everybody else.
Kilmar Abrego-Garcia denies being a criminal gang member, as the Trump administration claims. Senator demands evidence be presented in court. Two people, including a child, have died in Oklahoma flooding. Forecasters warn more flooding. Thunderstorms, tornadoes are expected from the Midwest to the South. Visitors to the Vatican on Easter Sunday got a treat, a surprise, at St. Peter's Basilica. At the end of the Easter service, Pope Francis showed up to bless the crowd.
Cari fratelli e sorelle.
And the Pope treated people in St. Peter's Square to a surprise Popemobile tour. This is ABC News.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
The Bucks lose to the Pacers. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with Sports NBA Playoffs. The Bucks essentially blown out by the Pacers in Indy. Game 1, the final 117-98. The Pacers were up by 24 points in the fourth quarter. After the game, Doc Rivers did not mince his words.
I thought our offense was awful. I thought our offense contributed as much to our defense as anything. We just didn't play the way we've played during this stretch offensively. And I thought we had a lot of missed shots, which allowed them to have a lot of breakouts. We had our mistakes defensively, too. They were shooting 60%.
Game 2 is Tuesday night. Baseball. Brewers losing to the A's 3-1. Despite the loss, manager Pat Murphy asked if he thought right-hand pitcher Chad Patrick is gaining confidence as a starter.
I would think so. That's a good, really good lineup, and he pitched really, really well. He pitched out of a jam. Yeah, I thought he was spot on tonight. He pitched well enough to win.
That's the Brewers' Pat Murphy with Sports on Mike Clemens.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. On our Easter Sunday, look for some showers in the afternoon with highs reaching the upper 50s. Gusty east winds will develop. For tonight, rain, even some thunderstorms around, and some of that rain will be locally heavy. Breezy as lows drop to the lower 40s. Right now, it's 48.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. While corrosive democracy news from Washington continued this week, state news ranged from good in Delaware and Mississippi, mixed in North Carolina and Pennsylvania, to downright ugly in New Hampshire. Voting Rights Lab reports the Delaware Senate advanced SB 2 and SB 3, constitutional amendments allowing 10 days of early voting and no excuse absentee voting. Legislative versions of both bills passed last year, but the Delaware Supreme Court found that the state constitution didn't enable them. The General Assembly must pass them again next year for them to be adopted. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals ordered Mississippi to redraw state Senate districts for DeSoto County, which it found violated the 1965 Voting Rights Act by diluting a majority black section of the county, according to Mississippi Today. State officials in North Carolina found fewer issues among the 5,000 military and overseas voters than the Supreme Court candidate Jefferson Griffin claimed, but the highly questionable post-election review of voter eligibility continues. Pennsylvania Attorney General Dave Sunday appealed a federal court ruling directing county officials to count otherwise eligible mail-in ballots without a date. The New Hampshire Senate advanced SB 213, which would require voters applying by mail for an absentee ballot to enclose a copy of their birth certificate, U.S. passport, or naturalization papers, almost certainly disenfranchising otherwise eligible voters. We have more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org.
Nightlight with Pete Schwalbe.
Mike Starr joins us here on Nightlight. Your timing, good fellas, Mike. What you just said was an ad lib to De Niro. He's like, security, and you're like, you're looking at him.
Well, that whole scene was improvised. And wow. He said, make sure you don't call it ad libbing. It's improvisation. It was quite a process that Martin Scorsese put us through over a few days that it would come out like that. It wasn't just like, hey, how you doing?
Nightlight with Pete Schwalbe. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, we'll talk about the price of oil with Mr. Global and what that means for consumers. Hour number two, we'll talk about organ donation. I hope you join us.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, joined in the studios here in Racine by my excellent producer, Max. And together in our second hour, we're going to be taking your inquiries and your questions about any of the issues we're discussing today. Once again, necessarily focusing upon the events, the circumstances, the petitions, the resolutions of those by our federal judges, including district court judges and appeals court judges, and yes, indeed, our United States Supreme Court. I hasten to add, as I necessarily must, that this is a lot. There is an awful lot going on, and one of the missions that we've adopted here on this broadcast is not to provide you with every last detail, but enough information so that you can understand the broad movements in all of this, the understandings that underplay and provide predicates for the decisions being made by district court judges, by appellate court judges, by Supreme Court justices as well. Give you some sense of the arguments being made, those that are being adopted, those that are being rejected. Not to grasp in its entirety the great numbers of things that are going on, even as we get together this weekend and every weekend to talk about these things, but to give you some sense about the great concern that all of us should have on this 250th anniversary of the shots heard around the world, Lexington and Concord, why it is important that we should not only be concerned, but we should ask ourselves now the question that we are in a constitutional crisis. What are we prepared to do? What are we prepared to do to preserve our republic as those Acton Minutemen of 250 years ago also ask themselves? We know that the Supreme Court in the early morning hours, yes, indeed, they were up in the first minutes of Saturday, April 19th, 2025, issuing an order blocking the Trump administration in yet another case involving the proposed deporting of another group of Venezuelan migrants to El Salvador. In an unsigned order giving no reasoning, as is often the case in these emergency petitions. Another issue we've talked about, the number of these happening expeditiously, government and others running very quickly, jumping over the normal procedures of our trial and appellate courts, this emergency docket, sometimes called the shadow docket. No reasoning. But decisions made by justices, this time in a brief unsigned order, the Supreme Court saying this, the government, that's the Trump administration, that's Pam Bondi, that's the Homeland Security Department, directing not to remove any member of the putative class of detainees, the people who are now identified as likely deportees from the United States until further order of this court, keep them grounded. Keep them here is what the Supreme Court said very early on the morning of Saturday. Interestingly, although we do not have reasoning, we do not have the kind of exposition that we'll hear, for example, from the Fourth Circuit in our second hour. We do know that Justices Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito both dissented. Both dissented. A 7-2 decision telling the Trump administration, don't you move any more of those detainees. How did this particular case come about? It is not the same case coming out of the courtrooms of Judge Boasberg and Judge Zinnes and others now around the nation. But we know that more than 50 Venezuelans were scheduled to be flown out of the country, presumably once again to El Salvador, from an immigration detention center. This time it's in Anson, Texas. And attorneys in recent days has already secured some orders barring similar deportations in other courts under this Alien Enemies Act, again, invoked by the administration. establishing, perhaps, by virtue of executive authority, that we are at war, that somehow we've been invaded. Interestingly, as an aside, our government telling us effectively that we are now at war with Venezuela, or at least with this group of terrorists, of gang members identified by the administration, that we may be at war, according to the president. And under the Alien Enemies Act, that's the basis upon which he is ordering not only the seizure, but the deportation of enemies in our land who pose a threat to the safety and security of all of us. In recent days, other court orders in other courts, places like New York City and Denver and Brownsville, Texas, all of them, again, it's a lot going on, all of them likewise enjoying the movement. The situation in Anson, however, was especially urgent because the lawyers had mounted challenges in three different courts in 5 hours, in five different hours, firing on all cylinders. The lawyers started with an emergency filing in a federal district court in Abilene, Texas. They claimed that officers of a place called the Blue Bonnet Detention Center in Anson had already started distributing notices, giving paper notices to some Venezuelan immigrants, informing them that they're about to be deported. They could face deportation as soon as Friday night, giving them some level, not enough, but some notice about what had happened. They asked a judge. His name is Judge James Wexley Hendricks, who is overseeing that particular case, to issue an immediate order protecting all the migrants in the Northern District of Texas who might face this imminent deportation. And when Judge Hendricks declined to grant their request initially and then later on, the lawyers filed a similar request with the Court of Appeals in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. They're located in New Orleans. The lawyers then also filed, again, shooting on all opportunities here, firing on all cylinders, this emergency petition to the Supreme Court, asking the justices to say they're getting on buses. They're being loaded onto planes, presumably very soon. You need to immediately pause that happening, stop any deportations, because many of the Venezuelan men had already been loaded onto buses, according to the petition to the Supreme Court, headed to the airport. Interestingly, all of this is happening again under these claims that these members are gang members under the Alien Enemies Act, this Tren de Aragua, this violent street gang. This is the predicate for the government to seek to have them remove and actually accomplish their removal from our nation, from the lands in which they do, in fact, get protection. During a hearing, again, back in the District of Columbia, in front of the same judge, before many of these lawyers, including the government, have been petitioning previously. Yes, that's James Boasberg again. Lots of moving, lots of split screens, lots of multiple screens here. Judge Boasberg entertained some additional argument in cases pending in front of him, and it was there. And the reason I raise it now is that the lawyers who are representing the detainees told James Boasberg on Friday night that they are prepared to file petitions in every single federal district court in the United States of America to stop this from happening. And a lot of their predicate, of course, was what happened, what came out of Judge Boasberg's court, went up to the Court of Appeals, ultimately the Supreme Court. You recall this well. We've talked about it. The Supreme Court issued this order saying that implicitly the administration can indeed invoke the Alien Enemies Act, but you have to provide due process. You have to give all these deportees, all the migrants, all the people you're planning to put on those buses and planes, you have to give them notice. You have to tell them what they're charged with, and you've got to ensure that they've got an opportunity to push back, to make defenses to the government. We call that due process. And the Supreme Court, even while it adopted this view, curious and odd and unsupported as it is, that somehow we're at war, that we've been invaded, and therefore the Alien Enemies Act is properly invoked, said, nonetheless, if you want to do this, Mr. President and Pam Bondi, Attorney General, you've got to make sure that everybody who gets on a plane anywhere has been given due process, and some judicial officer has told them that they must go, that they made the finding that they are indeed subject to removal under the Alien Enemies Act. Drew Ensign, this Deputy Assistant Attorney General about whom we've spoken a lot, a lawyer for the Justice Department, your Justice Department, gave his word that no flights were scheduled to depart from the Blue Bonnet Center on Friday night or even Saturday morning, April 19th, 2025, adding the migrants there would be given at least 24 hours notice before they were deported. Well, notice is good. That's good, Mr. Ensign. But Judge Boasberg, again, appropriately skeptical of all of this, these assertions. Judge Boasberg, of course, on the receiving end of many of the misrepresentations and refusal, basically, to provide basic information of the past month, pointed out to your government, had to tell the government, your Department of Justice, your president, your attorney general, that the notice forms the government is giving to these Venezuelan men did not contain the explicit due process statement that they were able to challenge their deportations. It's one thing, the judge was telling them, to provide notice, which again, is it in a language that they understand? Is it in English? We don't know yet. That is another issue, plainly, for a due process protection. It's one thing to tell them in whatever language that they're going to be leaving to state the obvious. It's another thing to say that you can, in fact, petition your government to push back on this, to challenge this action. And that's why this is so important. And that is exactly what the Supreme Court has said that your government must do. Question whether or not that is going on. On Friday, other Venezuelan migrants at the detention center, again, facing this imminent deportation. One of them, known simply as FGM, instructed to sign a removal waiver in English. Again, even though he speaks only Spanish. When he refused to sign, the immigration officers told him that the waiver was coming from the president. All right. That may, in fact, be true. The president of the United States of America is directing that this happen, that these migrants not be given due process, given a notice that they're going to be put on a bus and sent to El Salvador, but nothing more, and that you'll be deported if you did not sign this notice. That's what they were told. And that's what prompted, once again, this application, this emergency application granted, thankfully, by the Supreme Court in the very early hours of April 19th. One of these shots, not a physical shot, not a bullet shot, not a gunshot, but shots being volleyed right now inside our systems of justice, our courts, about what we do with due process, what this means, and what we mean as a nation. The Supreme Court, again, not a unanimous Supreme Court, nonetheless said, hold off, Mr. President, hold off, Pam Bondi, hold off, Homeland Security, State Department, Justice Department, do not put them on those buses. Do not put them in those planes. Don't you do that. And so we are waiting on April 19th, 2025, to see what the United States government, your government does, your Department of Justice does, Homeland Security does, in response to an unmistakably clear directive from the United States Supreme Court not to put anybody else on those planes. You recall the reason why this was so important is because on March 15th, when we were on the air here a month or so ago, all of this began to percolate up when in a courtroom of, yes, now let's move to James Boasberg once again. On that day, James Boasberg entertaining these arguments on behalf of what we learned since that time to be about 238 Venezuelans, they may in fact be violent. They may in fact be members of this gang. But the judge saying at that time that I'm directing you, government, not to put them on those planes. If those planes are in the air, turn them around. If they're still on the ground, do not tell the pilots to take off. That's what James Boasberg said on March 15th. And ever since then, in an attempt to determine whether or not your government, your Department of Justice, your Drew Ensigns of the world representing you in the federal district court have misrepresented, lied to a federal district court judge, he's been attempting for a month to figure out exactly when those planes left. Did they leave after he gave the order? In which case the government, yes, indeed, would be in contempt with a capital C. Or were they in the air? And did they land already in El Salvador? We still don't know. And the judge's simple questions of that day remain unanswered by your Department of Justice, prompting, of course, the judge, Judge Boasberg, just this past week, to make a probable cause finding, not only as to that issue, the contempt shown by your government to another branch of government, the contempt shown not only on that issue, but what have you done also to afford those 238, almost 250 migrants now sitting in that prison in El Salvador, the due process that now we know the Supreme Court has told us they are entitled to? What have you done to get them back here? And they're likewise, no response, no meaningful response, a lot of word salad, a lot of subversive language suggesting that things are being done without any specificity. But a federal judge as late as this past Wednesday, this is James Boasberg. He's the chief judge of the district court in the District of Columbia, opens up this high-stake contempt investigation into whether the Trump administration and Donald Trump has violated his order, not just contempt of court, but also raising questions beyond constitutional problems, but issues about the future of our republic. When we come back, we'll talk more about what Judge Boasberg did just this past week when this broadcast continues.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for Up North News Radio.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. In recent months, Milwaukee health officials have uncovered significant lead hazards in city schools, mostly due to lead-based paint. Several schools have now been closed as the problem has been found to be more widespread. In late March, city officials formally requested help from the CDC, but in doing so, they learned that the CDC's entire lead program had been eliminated by Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. This is a major problem. Children in the state's largest city are being exposed to lead poisoning at their schools, and the Trump administration is not only refusing to provide assistance, they are eliminating the entire lead program that would help in cases like this one. Now, state and local officials must step up to do something for these kids, since Trump and RFK Jr. are gutting federal support. Milwaukee's children deserve better.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area and on our website at civicmedia.us.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for Matinee on Air.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel here in the broadcast venue of Civic Media here in Racine. In the second hour, taking your calls, taking your questions, your comments, obviously by telephone, that's 855-752-4842, but also on the Dropbox. Be a part of our discussion at this critically important time, once again, in our nation's history, observing today the 250th anniversary of the shots heard around the world, asking once again on this broadcast, as we do implicitly every broadcast, what are you prepared to do to preserve your republic? We're speaking now about these events of the past several days that underscore the volatile time in which we are living when we are threatened with the future of our republic. Supreme Court late last night, actually early Saturday morning, telling the administration, do not send these Venezuelan migrants on. We'll see what the response is, if there is contempt by this administration, or in the wake of an explicit order from the Supreme Court, which this president has promised to follow. At least he's said that out loud. What is the administration going to do in the hours and days just ahead? We know that this past Wednesday, James Boasberg, the district court judge, the chief judge in the District of Columbia, absolutely at his wit's end, exasperated by the representations and misrepresentations by Department of Justice lawyers who are sworn to take an oath not only to you, to the government, to the Department of Justice, not to the president. They do not serve as the president's lawyers. They serve as your lawyers. But also they have an oath of office as representatives of the bar to be straightforward. And when asked questions for which there is no privilege, no other protection under law, obliged to respond or at least to find out. That's what I did for 30 years. That's what every single assistant U.S. attorney and U.S. attorney has done for time immemorial. We respect, even if we disagree with the decisions, the rulings, the directives of federal district court judges, when they ask information for information, you provide it. Our government is not doing that. Sending James Boasberg Through the roof again this past week, this past Wednesday. The judge, again, entertaining an argument about what is going on. Should he find the government in contempt, not only with respect to what happened on March 15th, but again, about whether or not you have followed his directives to provide due process to those 238 people in that prison in El Salvador. A 46-page ruling. 46 pages, James Boasberg said he is going to begin contempt proceedings. That is no small thing for a district court judge to do. Against whom? Against the administration, against the White House, against your Department of Justice, and asking what it had to do to get the answers that it wanted and to get the assurances that the rule of law is observed in this nation. Giving scores of Venezuelan men deported to El Salvador under this so-called expansive wartime authority, a challenge to the opportunity to challenge the removal. Here's what the judge wrote. He said, the court does not reach such conclusions lightly or hastily. Indeed, this is rare. It's not unprecedented, but it is rare. He said, indeed, it has given defendants, meaning your administration, your president, your attorney general, your secretary of Homeland Security, ample opportunity to explain their answers. Listen to this. None of their responses has been satisfactory. He is threatening contempt proceedings, and he is promising more down the road. Let's talk a little bit more about contempt proceedings. We've done this in the past. The federal district courts, the appeals courts, the district court, the Supreme Court, has capacity under language of statute passed by the Congress. Here's your moment of civics, as we sometimes get into in the law school that sometimes is amicus law review. It's section 401 of Title 18 of the United States Code. It's in the criminal law section of our statutes. It says, a court of the United States shall have the power to punish by fine or imprisonment or both, in its discretion, such contempt of its authority and none other as misbehavior of any person in its presence or so near thereto as to obstruct the administration of justice. That seems to qualify. Misbehavior of any of its officers in their official transactions. Again, invocation. And here it is. Number three, disobedience or resistance to its lawful writ, process, order, rule, decree, or command. There is another section, section 402, which we've seen invoked recently by the Department of Justice, which Judge Boasberg has also implicitly made reference to, talking about the mechanisms for enforcing contempt through criminal prosecution. People, corporations, associations willfully disobeying any of these writs or processes or decrees by doing any of these acts or thereby forbidden from doing them. If their act, their doing that, is of such a character as to constitute a criminal offense, that can be prosecuted for contempt as provided under other sections of this law. That's the predicate. This judge has not only the discretion, but the legislative, the statutory authority to impose these kinds of remedies. Yes, indeed, sanctions, fines, and indeed imprisonment. And what does James Boasberg do? This is the jurist, again, who now is affording your government, who has thwarted his questions, has told him, given him answers in ways that make no sense, told him that they don't have the information somehow, and basically stonewalled him, invoking once again the language of Richard Nixon from the 1970s, refused to provide the judge the basic information that he is entitled to get. How has Judge Boasberg responded? He says, you know what? I'm going to give you, the attorneys who are appearing in front of me, the parties, namely Department of Justice, your government, I'm going to give you due process in my court. The due process that you appear to have denied to those 250 people in El Salvador, maybe also denying the 50 people in Texas and others around the country, you're not affording due process to other people in this nation. But Judge Boasberg, to his amazing credit, he does what a judge should do. He says, I'm going to give you due process. And here's what he says. He says, I'm very angry. That's my word, not his. I won't read exactly all the things that he said. We've visited some of that in the past. But he talks about this fragile balance of power between the executive and the judicial branches. And he said, should administration officials slow walk those efforts to respond to him further? They've already done that. It's been a month when a simple question has not been answered, like, when did the planes take off? What are you doing right now to get these people back? Those answers, those questions, not answered. Judge Boasberg warned that he could make a criminal referral to the Justice Department or even appoint an outside prosecutor. What does he say in particular? Let's unpack that. Let's talk about the due process that this judge is going to afford these defendants in his courtroom. We're going to talk about all of that, the roadmap he provided to what happens next in his courtroom. We'll talk about Judge Zinnes, and we'll talk about the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in our second hour as Amicus Law Review continues.
This is the talk of La Crosse, Eagle 1490 AM. Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome Milwaukee Film Festival Program Director Kirsten Larson and Tim Sowers from the Overture Center in Madison discusses their new lineup. Let's light it up.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8.
Why'd I go to the doctor? My heart would race just taking my son to practice. It didn't feel right. So I got checked out. Turns out I have atrial fibrillation, which increases the risk of stroke about 5 times.
Symptoms like irregular heartbeat, heart racing, chest pain, shortness of breath, fatigue, or lightheadedness can come and go. But if it's AFib, the risk of stroke remains. If you have symptoms, contact a doctor.
I'm so glad I did.
Visit notimetowait.com, sponsored by Bristol-Myers Squibb and Pfizer.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us. Soaring high above La Crosse, this is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse. And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. Saying he's fighting for everyone in America's constitutional due process rights, Senator Chris Van Hollen, Maryland Democrat, about his trip to El Salvador, where a man from Maryland was wrongly taken to a notorious prison.
I don't think it's ever wrong to protect the Constitution and protect due process rights.
Kilmar Abrego Garcia denies being a criminal gang member. The senator demands evidence be presented in court by the Trump administration. Cleanup after tornadoes in southwest Oklahoma yesterday. Forecasters warn more flooding, thunderstorms, and tornadoes are expected from the Midwest to the south. A surprise for visitors Easter Sunday at St. Peter's Basilica, Pope Francis showed up to bless the crowd.
Cari fratelli.